Mr. Watson, Reel 7. We were just talking about how you fired from the Anson, the Lewis guns. You said you called them up as you approached.
Yeah, the pilot did. He called up, coming into the range, you see, and the army bloke said, range clear, you know, carry on. And so the pilot said, right, we're getting a run, words to that effect. And he shouted to the gunner, right, we're coming up to the target now, get ready. And you got there and you fired. Don't fire until the post appears opposite you. White post, right. And these tanks, and it's nice to see the tracer shooting off them and all this. And right up, right, stop firing! So, because we were approaching the white other one. Right. Now, it sometimes happened that you had a runaway gun. Now, the trick was, if you had a runaway gun, of course, some of the blokes went panicked, you see, and just... The trick was to lift the breech, the lid, you know, of the covering the breech block, because that stopped the feed, you see. The rounds jumped up, but they kind of jump up in your face, and people were a bit dodgy about it. Anyway, I'm down there in the right-hand seat waiting my turn, and there's another chap, he's up in the turret. So, right, start firing, fires up, right, stop firing, and he comes, right, turns around, right, he's coming back on the other side, start firing, and sparking up on all these wrecks, and we're coming down past his post. Stop firing, you bloody idiot! Stop firing! Run with the aircraft. Full. And the guy. And what had happened? He continued firing. And as he came past these huts, the bullets started going through the roof of the tin huts. And the Swannies having their afternoon of smoke, lying in their bunks, apparently. And suddenly the roof of the hut became pierced with bloody bullets, and they were hitting the, you know, the metal struts of the hut and bouncing. Oh my God, the pilot, you bloody fool, they'll get our letters. Oh, he's down under the ground. Sort of, but of course they had a record of which aircraft it was. When we got back, the wing commander flying was out, everybody was out after our blood, and the poor bloke who was in the town, why the bloody, why didn't you, oh, he was panicked, he didn't know what to do. The gun was we had a great laugh at it afterwards, but I suppose the Swannies didn't think much of it.
No one was actually hit then.
No one.
They were lucky.
But they were lying in their beds and they were. Oh, God.
What else about the training while you were there?
Air drogue towing. An aircraft towed a sleeve, and the attacking aircraft, that's us in the turret, the gunner in the turret, fired at the drogue. It was towed about 300 yards behind the towing aircraft. Now, there were two gunners taking in turns to fire, and in order to identify who had hit the target, the ammunition was coloured red and green. And this was done by the belts being coiled up and dipped in a shallow tray of green dye or red dye or whatever it was. And when you went into the aircraft, whoever fired, of course, noted the colour of the dye that the guns were firing, so that his hits could be identified on the sleeve as it penetrated the cotton sleeve. And when they came back, of course, the armourers counted the number of hits, if any, in the sleeve. And this was noted in your record of gunnery. That was one way. The other was where we fired from a gun position, and there was a circular railway leading about 500 yards distant, semicircular. Well, it was a miniature railway, or shall we say a small gauge railway. It wasn't just a tiny thing. It's about half the size of a railway engine. And it towed a wooden target behind it with a canvas screen on it. And once again, as it moved round, the speed that it went, of course, changed. And the angle to the gunner changed. So it was a chance to assess the gunner's ability to judge any ground target where he's moving above the target, except that the target was moving instead of the gunner. So it was another method of teaching gunner. It was called a strafing exercise, ground strafing, an attempt to teach you how to deal with ground targets, moving transport or something of that nature.
Anything else you recall?
Air to sea consisted of them dropping a aluminium, I think it was, a marker on the sea. This didn't, it sort of floated, left a grey patch on the surface of the water, and the aircraft circled round and came flying in towards it, and you attempted to hit this patch of supposed to be a submarine surfacing or something like that. That was air to sea. What's this?
Now the course went on from January 44 to March 44. Mm. Was there a final testing, or was it just sort of continuous?
It's continuous assessment. Some left the course.
Why did they leave?
I don't know. Well, you know, it's either that they might have got air sick, or might have failed some of these exercises. There's no doubt. As the course progressed, people were getting a bit nearer the day when they were going to really, this sort of black and white exercise. You were becoming nearer operational. And I think some of them, I don't know whether they got pressure from home or what, but some of them began to think twice about it. So the glamour of the half wing was receding, I think, in some cases. And I think air sickness had a lot to do with it. These aircraft, you bounced about a lot in these trainers.
So at number 4 Air Gunner School, we ought to make clear, wasn't at Bridgnorth. That was at Morpeth.
That's right.
And that's what you're talking about. Mm. That's where you met the officer from 204 Squadron,
that's right.
At Morpeth.
No.
It's confused in your mind between Bridgnorth and Morpeth.
Yeah. It's definitely Bridgnorth I met him, because I was invited to his house for tea.
That's fine, but you weren't at Bridgnorth very long, were you?
No. No, not very long. It was these stations.
So where did you do all the stuff about the shooting and the cine film and the shooting from the Anson and the rest of it? That was at Morpeth.
Morpeth.
Right. Okay. So where did you go next? According to your record, it was 18 OTU. That would stand for
Finningley. Finningley.
And what does OTU stand for?
Operational Training Unit.
And what was the setup there? You went there in April 1944.
Yeah. An operational training unit was where the various members of the crews assembled for combined crew training and you did a lot of intelligence, attended a lot of intelligence lectures as aircrew members. There were pilots, a lot, except the engineer. So the pilot, the navigator, the bomb aimer and the air gunners assembled the operational training unit, excluding the flight engineer. And the reason for that is that the aircraft were Wellingtons and there was no necessity for a flight engineer because they only had two engines.
Now, what can you give us a brief description of the Wellington? Well, brief, as long as you want, of the Wellington. What were its characteristics?
It was a two-engine bomber. It was It was a heavy bomber, along with the Whitley, the two twin-engine aircraft. It was a heavy bomber that we had until the four-engine Halifax and Lancaster came in. So it was a two-engine metal-bodied body, and I think it was capable of taking about 4,000 to 6,000 pounds of bombs. It was used at the OTU to take leaflets, propaganda leaflets, and drop them over enemy territory or French territory, occupied territory.
How did the training start, the operational training?
It started with a lot of lectures. And I think part of that was to get the air crews who wouldn't get the airmen, the various trades, gunners, navigators, bombers, except the flight engineers, mixing. Because at the OTU, you crewed up. And it was a voluntary crewing up. You weren't detailed into a crew. You sort of made friends with various people. And probably playing snooker or in the bar or probably, you know, anywhere in the town or in a pub even, and made friends, and gradually you accumulated a crew with the exception of the flight engineer. Now, that was the way it happened.
What would the lectures be about?
Mainly escaping as a prisoner of war, techniques, you know, how to survive, what not to do, which was very important, and about the Stalag Luft habits. And one of the main things was to make it as awkward as possible for the prison guards. In other words, if you're keeping them occupied, it was a good thing. And they had escapees. There weren't many, but they had one or two who had escaped and who went round the various OTUs describing ways in which they could make it awkward for the prison guards. And the other thing was where to make for, and describing how these
escape maps.
We also were issued with a compass in a pencil, a compass pencil clip, which I gave to my son to take to school, and he never, of course, got it back. And the I lost last year, or 2 years ago, when I went to Ben Beckland, had some of this stuff to show people. My daughter asked me to bring it. And my little compass, it was a button compass, we used to put them in the padded part of the brevi to hide it. It disappeared.
So that was what the lectures were about?
That's what the lectures were about, to explain how to escape, where to escape to, how to conceal a compass, try to take a compass with you and make sure you're not walking into Germany and out of Germany.
What was the next stage of the training? You had the sort of informal formation of crews, you got the lectures.
Then we went from there to the flying part of it. It was twin engine Wellingtons, as I say, and we were sent to, oh gosh, Finningley, where the devil did we go for? I think we
should. Firing at Mablethorpe.
Yes, well, we did that, but the twin engine flying in the Wellington at the OTU was mainly for the training of the pilots and the navigators. There was very little gunnery training because the pilot hadn't flown a heavy aircraft, and the main emphasis was in getting him fit for flying, and the navigator. We did practice bombing, the bombing range. This was to train the bombing there. He'd already done bit of navigational training and so on.
So the air training was where you gradually trained up the crew working
exactly
together.
Exactly. But it was mainly, principally, of course, for the chap handling the aircraft, because, I mean, he hadn't handled a heavy aircraft before, and he was going on to handling four-engine aircraft eventually, so he needed to know what he was doing with the two-engine jobs.
Now, you started flying with Sergeant Moore. At that
yes.
point, Ken Moore.
Ken Moore.
He was your pilot.
He was a pilot.
What was Ken Moore like? How did you come to pick on him?
I don't know. He picked on me, I think. Well, he picked the navigator, and then I don't know how it happened after that. We just sort of we're all playing snooker. Well, I was standing, and another air gunner was standing, and some others were standing around watching two chaps playing snooker on the table. And Ken came up to me, he was standing over there, and he says, "Are you crewed up yet?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, I've got Ian Miller, he's a navigator, you want to come with us?" I said, "Yeah, fine." That's all that was said.
And the other crew were Roland Goods, Wireless Operator. Did you pick him up then, or was that later?
Ken had introduced me to his navigator.
That's Ian Miller, yeah.
Ian Miller. He was an Aussie, and he was a friend of Roland Goods. And he said, "Oh, I know a wireless op, a good chap, an Aussie." So Ken said, "We'll fight fair enough."
Stan Hammond, the bomb aimer.
Yes, Stan.
And finally, Frank Harvey. Did you meet him there?
He was standing beside me, and Ken came over and said, he says, "Do you know any other chap, gunner?" I think Harvey said, "Well, I'm not crewed up yet." And I said, Ken says, "Okay then." So that's it.
And at this stage, what about you? Didn't meet the flight engineer?
No.
That would be Jimmy Grimley, but you didn't meet. So this is the crew that you started flying with?
Yes, on Wellingtons.
And how did the early flights go?
Oh, mainly practice bombing and navigational exercises and things.
And how did you get on? What were these characters like? What was Ken Moore like?
Well, I don't know. He worked for, when he, before he joined, he was a floor walker in Burton's stores, you know, selling suits, 30 bob suits. So he was all right. He's very easy to get on with, and we never had any sort of hard words or anything. It's all very.
So you got on well with all of them?
Yeah. There was no. The only one who used to get excited was Jimmy Grindley from Glasgow. He was a Clyde Bank man. And he used to get terribly excited.
He was the flight engineer?
That's later, of course, when we met him.
So you seem to have done lots of circuits and landings?
Yes, that's it.
Cross-country, bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, did you do any of these dropping of propaganda leaflets at this stage?
Yes.
There's something called Nickel.
That's it.
And Nickel, Tourcoing.
Yeah. And Nickel was a code name for dropping leaflets. You see the leaflets in there. Some leaflets in there.
And tell me exactly what the trips, the Nickel trips were like. You seem to have done two of them at this stage.
Yes, yes.
What were they like?
They were jolly uncomfortable, I would say. Frightening in some cases. And Nickel was also a spoof for the main force. Spoof was a dummy raid intended to send the German night fighter force after us and divert the main force from going to its target. Now, so you've got, it was called a spoof, I think it describes it.
And so it was not only dropping propaganda, Nick, yeah. It was also a
attracting
spoof, a diversionary raid.
Yeah, a diversionary raid. We call them spoofs. The difficulty was, of course, that the Germans often took the spoof to be the real thing and sent their night fighter force hell-bent towards us instead of the main attack.
So what do you remember of them?
Well,
either Argentan or Tourcoing, they were. You went on them in May, mid-May,
I remember that was before the invasion. And the result was that northern France was Rommel's Atlantic Wall. And he had a, right across, opposite the south coast of England, right out to the peninsula, Argentine, out west, Cap Grigny, and out that way. He had a defence force because he was expecting the invasion to come. So he had the whole of the south side of the channel as Atlantic Wall. Now our game was to come out across that, where you got a hell of a battering, naturally, and our target was on the northwest of France. And this was really to keep them occupied all the way along there, not knowing where the invasion was going to be. And what they were doing was trying to convince them that it was going to be across to Calais rather than where they eventually went. And the main force went out towards Holland and out towards Germany, depending on the target. But the idea was to, the night fighter force, Rommel's Air Force, the airfields were all along the north coast of France, and they could quickly deploy them. So of course when we went across there, whack, and the main force went out here, of course. So it was a diversion to take the attention away from the heavy bombers
What do you remember of happening on the raids? Or do you not remember them too clearly now?
Let me think now. I don't think, apart from the battering we got from Flack, but there's nothing else. Oh yes, coming back, that was a problem. We went there, it's northwest France, and these leaflets were dropped. You can see them there. And before they went, I went to the Bombay, and they were in clamps, these leaflets. And I managed to prize out one or a few. They've gone in souvenirs, you know, since then. Got one or two left. Pulled them out. They were mainly to encourage the French people, you know, that we hadn't forgotten them. And also, we dropped fake, but this was later, so I won't divert, fake bread coupons in Germany.
So, that, you came under heavy flak. What, were you nervous?
I can't recollect being nervous. We were tensed up. I suppose I were.
About 4-hour flights.
Oh, it was bloody cold. But what we got was a hell of a reception when we came back. Because having dropped our stuff and done a second go past the Rommel's Atlantic Wall, we came across the Channel. And when we got up to near Bournemouth, all hell went loose. Because the German fighters had got into our stream and they sent down 2 Wellingtons, I think it was. And, of course, they were coming over the Channel, and the Bournemouth, all the south coast was radar. They were picking up their radar, and they were also picking us up, you see. And they thought that, well, there were Ju-88s, they got onto us, and they were following us back. So their signal was coming across amongst ours. We put on a signal which told them that we were friendly, but mixed up was the German. Well, when we got to Bournemouth, my God, the anti-aircraft fire sent us rocketing about all the place. And it got so bad that, the aircraft was becoming uncontrollable. Ken was wrestling with the blooming thing and was flying, heaving about.
And where were you in the Wellington? Can you describe your...
tail turret.
What was the tail turret like? Can you just describe the Wellington tail turret?
4 guns, control column in the middle, ammunition belts came between your legs and fed to the 4 guns in front of your face.
And the guns were which type?
Browning's 303. The control column was very sensitive. It had 2 grips, triggers, like this is how I'm describing it. The grip came up through here. Ammunition came up through. There was 2 guards, so it didn't bash your knees. And the belts came along tracks underneath and were conveyed up on these little cogs, you know, just like a chain, up through your legs. And they came into the guns like that, and when you fired the guns, they were going like that in front of your face. You had to watch you didn't get your oxygen mask tangled up with it. And of course, you could, if you put a pencil in one of the gun muzzles on the ground and put a card on it, the controls were so sensitive you could actually sign your name on it. Not as small as you would write, but, legibly. They were very, very sensitive. And the triggers were, of course, just... There were 2 grips like that, and that fired 4 guns.
And you aimed by...?
Up here was a reflector sight.
Up in ahead of your head?
Ahead of your head. And it was the same as a Spitfire. Same sight.